Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. It was a novel idea. Invite the public into a prison for a five-course meal, complete with white linen tablecloths and bouquets of magenta roses and lilies, using ingredients grown and prepared by the men at Grafton Correctional Institution, under the tutelage of an award-winning chef. 60 hungry customers showed up, and they got to see the inmates as gardeners, chefs, and waiters. Joining us now is Chef Brandon Krzysztofski, founder, president, and CEO of the Cleveland-based Edwin's Leadership and Restaurant Institute. Welcome to All Sides, Chef Brandon.
Hey, what's going on? How are we feeling?
Good. How are you?
Good. Really good. Really good.
So how did the idea to invite the public to a five-course meal at a prison come about?
Dude, this was like the simplest method of doing anything. So, you know, we've been teaching in this particular prison for about 12 years. And these men, particularly those that are tending the garden, it was really simple. I came in to teach a business class. I said, how's the garden going? He pulls up a beet. I bite the beet. I said, this is the best damn beet I've ever had. And I said, we've got to highlight this in some way, shape, or form. And at first I thought about county fairs. I thought about doing something to that, you know, like best in show beet. And I said, we'll just blow it open and do a dinner, open to the public, and let's shoot our shot.
And how did you get the warden of the prison on board? I mean, I assume there just has to be some sort of logistics in bringing 60 civilians in. It looks like it was outdoors in the recreation area of the prison.
Yeah, it was in our garden, which is, yes, it's outdoors. Yeah, right next to where everyone's working out and getting big, right? You know, like, and this is like such a deeper, like, answer. I can tell you, you know, I called Warden Jerry and he said yes. But you just got to go back and just look at our leadership in our state, you know, not just our governor now, but the governor before and the governor before that, and their approach to rehabilitation and correction. You know, there's been a longstanding group of leaders who said that it's, you know, literally in our title for the state, it's not just Department of Corrections, it's Corrections and Rehabilitation. So throughout this great leadership, they've put great, you know, people in charge of these prisons. And they've said, we want to push programming. We want people not to come back. And, you know, that's how we got someone like Warden Jerry to say, you know, he's the right guy and supported by the right leadership to say, okay. I mean, it was literally as simple as that. He's like, let's do it.
You have a long association with Grafton Correctional Institution. It looks like you began offering classes there more than a decade ago. Yep. Can you tell us a little bit about these classes? I understand it's about 6 months and you teach them like cooking, safety, sanitation, knife skills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Inside the yard, we teach exactly what you said. And, you know, it stretches for maybe like 8 or 9 months. It's once a week, you know, it's the frequencies on every Saturday. And we just started, you know, with basics, right? I mean, that's basic sanitation, basic knife skills, basic mother sauces. Now the program on the outside, Edwin's here, right? I mean, we've got, you know, 4 restaurants, 7 buildings for housing, a childcare center. I mean, it's really the national model, but it all began there in Grafton Prison. And we continue to do that to today.
What first drew you to Grafton Prison? What made you want to offer the very first course?
It was thinking through. So I had this idea. I mean, I've had this idea for 20 years now about having a school that's a restaurant and a restaurant that's a school. And you know, someone asked me, they prompted me, said, well, why aren't you doing this now? And I said, that's a good question. So I went to the closest prison. I shagged up with a guy named Adam Kassler, and his goal was to have this institution become the best institution for programming. And so I wanted to have the best culinary arts program in prison. And so on a handshake, we just went to it, man. I mean, it was seriously as simple as that 12 years ago.
Edwin's is one of the largest educators in U.S. prisons. You're active in 43 states. So it's this is a big enterprise across the country.
Yeah, we're actually the number one educator in prisons in North America, or not in North America, in the United States of America. Yeah, we reach over 117,000 people. And, you know, just in Ohio alone, we're reaching 50,000 people on these tablets. But, I mean, look, you just drive. The one thing I won't ask for is funds. You know, the goal is just access. And now access has granted us this web of reach. And the reach now is really allowing people to dream in the darkest of places that they can be chefs, or they can be, you know, maitre d's, or they can be somebody in this business. And so it's been pretty cool to see the development of this.
Yeah, I heard you describe it in another interview as reframing what is possible in prison. And I like that description.
I think that's a politically correct way to see it, right?
Yeah, the Associated Press showed up for that recent dinner at Grafton Prison. And I want to play a clip of the warden, Jerry Spetny.
Many of our guys that live here are going home. So they're going home to be our neighbors. We want our neighbors to be prepared to be law-abiding citizens, and that's what this program is about. It's not just about teaching guys how to cook or how to prepare food. This gives them reentry level skills so that when they go home, they can be successful in that environment.
Have you found that to be true? Have you talked with graduates, had them work in your restaurants? Have you seen them once they get out?
Oh, I'm gonna get 100%. Yeah, I mean, look at this whole thing's about rehumanization. You know, you can cut it up and say whatever political spin you want. You know, education and this and that and reform, and it's they're all absolutely correct. But at the end of the day, it's the rehumanization of somebody that prison or poverty stripped away. And if you can kind of feed that back into someone, they are more likely to become stronger, especially when you return home, and therefore you have a career. But that's what Warren Jerry says 100% correct. And I would just say, when you see someone becoming human again, I think it's probably the most powerful thing we can teach.
Yeah, I want to play a clip from one of the inmates, Greg Ziegmiller, about his experience.
It's a program that I actually want to carry to the outside when I leave here. There's so many different opportunities that they make available to us, and they actually care. This could be the rest of my life, and they're doing this for everybody. They're not looking at me as a number, they're looking at me as a person.
That they're not looking at me as a number, they're looking at me as a person. I think that sums it up really well. It got me because I was like, yeah, I think sometimes it's so easy to imagine the people in prison as these other people, these people who aren't like us.
You know, I'd say like we'll have, you know, like a banker's box, right? I think everyone can have. Or a milk crate, right? I mean, everyone can understand the size of that. I mean, that's how many letters we're getting a week, you know, from around the country. And, you know, people say things like that. Is this real? You know, like I really need an opportunity to change my life. They're inspired by the program, or, you know, they've been out of jail their whole life and you know, never thought I would get such happiness working a regular job until they took this course. Yeah, I mean, the comments are basically like just, you know, it's humanity, right? It's just being human. I'm like I'm no genius, okay? It's just very simple. Just treat others like you want to be treated. You've heard that a million times for a million years. A caveman probably said it, but it's like so true. And that's all we do is, and you know, of course we make some great food, but yeah.
What has been the reaction from the people that have attended the dinner? Like, what do you hear from the guests?
Yeah, I mean it shook them. You know what I mean? It shook them. They're you know, saying it was the one thing that changed their life. They look at a lot of things differently. And you know, you got to schlep all the way down to Grafton. I mean, if anyone's familiar with from like Cleveland to Grafton, like 45-minute hike, man. You're like in the middle of nowhere, and like you're going. I mean, what are you thinking? Like, I don't know. I think that was probably like part of the setup. You know, mentally you're not prepared for what you're about to hit you, and then you come in there and you're just like, oh my gosh. And this garden, you have to understand, man. Like, you know, you're not allowed to have like hoses or ropes longer than 6 feet, right? Because you know it could be it's not a good idea in prisons to have. So the men that are tending this garden are literally walking buckets of water to water a garden about a half acre, you know, 100 yards, 50 yards, you know. The care, the hard work, the love that someone has for this land and this product, I think made that dinner even more powerful. And for people to understand, like, oh my gosh, if you're gonna go through this to make great corn, we have a deeper appreciation for, you know, your ethic, your humanity.
Yeah, one of the things I noticed in the documentary is the knives and other tools are like tethered to the counters. So there are slight differences just in the way like a commercial kitchen would operate. And obviously, that's just the constraints of working within a correctional facility.
Those are the rules, right? But I mean,
Yeah.
when I started this class 12 years ago, like that was never happening. people were not bringing knives into prisons. Like, this was like, not, like, what are you, crazy? But again, man, great leadership from the governor and the director of ODRC and then the warden. And like, it's like this whole, like, it spills over mentality, and it's really led to the fact that you can get a knife in there. And you know, the haul, the blade is higher, and the string is quite light. You know, before they would literally have a bike chain tethered to a, you know, 1-inch hauled knife. I mean, it was impossible to, it was literally something that you could use to cut through something, but no way, shape, or form to be able to teach how to julienne or Benoist or how to, you know, do something right. But look, yeah, I will tell you, like, listen, like, the first day of knife skills we did there, the first class, the first day, I mean, everyone, like, I mean, I'm talking some big dudes, they kept cutting themselves, you know, and they would come out of the kitchen, they'd be like, and everyone would be like holding their finger up, because we had two classes, one learning academic in the chow hall and one in the kitchen cutting, and I was teaching the class in the chow hall, and I kept seeing one guy after another come out and band-aid, and the other guys are like, I don't know if I want to go in there, because these knives are razor sharp, man, like, if you don't hold it right. So it
You got to
was
make
kind of
that
like,
little claw to protect your fingers.
yeah. You're absolutely right, but the claw wasn't happening in the first class. But so I thought they were going to shut us down right away, man. Fortunately, they didn't.
I mean, knife skills are one of those things that, I mean, that kind of safety is so important, particularly if you like to work with sharp knives, which you should because they cut better.
You know, they say in the kitchen, a sharp knife will never cut you, you know, because you don't have to work so hard. But if you can't hold it right, and the ultimate insult to any chef is that stupid iron glove. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I
It's
think
like
I've
this
seen those. They're
medieval.
like chain meal. Yeah.
I would never bring it up. And then one guy was like, maybe we should bring it. I'm like, absolutely not. They're going to be chefs. They're not going to be, you know. So that was kind of funny.
Knights of the Round Table. Yeah. So, are there plans to do more dinners at Grafton? More dinners maybe across the state of Ohio?
Yeah, I mean, like, look, this is the first of its kind ever, right? I mean, no one's ever done this in the state or even beyond that we found. So we'll definitely, you know, ride this wave. We'll definitely do it in Grafton as every year celebrate the harvest, 100% sure. But yeah, we could certainly try to like copy paste this into other institutions, and would love to.
How does one get tickets? Or I guess how do you get into the dinner is the better question.
So I mean, well. I mean, we're pretty simple now that, you know, we got a relationship. I'll let you know so you can blast your listeners. But we just put on our website. We send out like an email, right? We put on social media, like the, you know, 2024 ways of marketing, and then people sign up. The only thing is, you know, 30 days before the event, we have to cut it off because the state requires that with the list of names and everything. So
Oh, you get a little bit of a background check.
I would call it a thorough rinse.
Yeah. No, that makes sense, actually, since I think about it.
Yeah, but it's cool, you know. It's like oftentimes you're taking a reservation for a guest. Oh, thank you, Mrs. Jones. Can we have your phone number? Oh, thank you. And now it's like, what's your date of birth?
Your social
The
security
last four years
number, what's your
social? Yeah,
ad?
where's your last residence? And so our hospitality skills have really got to increase.
No, that makes sense, actually. There'd just be that little bit of extra consideration. And I think I would assume most people are like, yeah, actually, I'm going to go have dinner at a prison. There's going to be a little more scrutiny. I mean, I don't know. I'm a journalist. I'm used to getting, like, when you get up to certain, like, high level, like, you get a little more of a background check when you're going to certain places.
Yeah, but I'd say the most beautiful part, I mean, like, this is maybe I'm old school, man. I come up in French, you know, classic way in Paris and New York, whatever. But the only thing you can bring inside that prison is yourself and an ID. Okay, there's no handbags, there's no cell phones, there's nothing. It's like,
Oh.
so you are like totally locked in to your food, like the way it should be, like this is the way it used to be, right? I mean,
There's no
you're totally
scrolling on
locked
your
in.
phone during dinner.
And there's no like the phone eats first kind of mentality. You're locked into your guest, you know. I mean, it's just like it's really pure to see that again. And so if that's what it takes, maybe I just open a restaurant in prison now.
Or maybe you have, some concerts have that restriction where you have to put your phone like in a box before you go in because they don't want certain photographs. You could do that at the restaurant.
Ooh, okay, all right. I'm on it, man.
That was Chef Brandon Kratowski, founder, president, and CEO of the Cleveland-based Edwin's Leadership and Restaurant Institute. Thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks, Anna.
Coming up, an educational exchange program between Ohio State University and the prison system. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. When we imagine going to college, I suspect most of us don't imagine going to a class in a prison. But that's what students at Ohio State University do if they're part of the Ohio Prison Education Exchange Project. Students there learn side by side with incarcerated students. And T.E. Morris is one of the faculty advisors. She's a professor of African American and African Studies at Ohio State's Newark campus. And she joins us now. Welcome to All Sides, Dr. Morris.
Thank you for having me.
Where did this idea for a co-educational classroom inside a prison begin?
Well, several years ago, Dr. Mary Thomas, who is the co-director of OPEEP along with me, and another faculty member at OSU Newark, wanted to expand the teaching that we were doing. So OSU faculty have been teaching at prisons in Central Ohio for about 15 years now. And we wanted to grow that and to increase the impact that we were having for justice-impacted individuals. So we decided to sort of centralize that process and create a system whereby we could teach in several prisons and increase both the impact on incarcerated learners as well as campus students.
What did the university say when you're like, hey, we'd like to take students and take them to these correctional facilities for classes?
The university was actually enthusiastic and supportive. They understand the work that we do as community engagement, and they see it as a way of increasing awareness for students who are interested in entering criminology as a profession or those who are interested in social justice to really increase their awareness and understanding of the carceral state, to break down the barriers that exist and the stereotypes that we have about incarcerated individuals. And it really just broadens their experience in general about what we need to do as a community to support returned citizens.
Yeah, one of the things I found fascinating is a lot of the students are criminal justice majors, so they could go on to become law enforcement, judges, lawyers, social workers. There's a whole host of ways that they could interact with the system, and they're having these early interactions where they're both students rather than coming to it fresh as the correctional officer. Does that make sense?
Exactly. And that is really important in the way that they will approach that work. So they are not solely inundated with the stereotypes that we typically have access to on TV shows and in the news stories that we often hear. They are face-to-face and learning alongside and creating and producing knowledge with other human beings. And so being in this space, in this class, really allows them to see beyond the labels that incarcerated people are usually given and are able to connect with them on really a human level.
I want to play a clip of a student named Kaylee, who is a past participant, and she's speaking about the program.
If you have any inkling of an interest, to definitely go for it. I know it can seem like really scary to sign up for a class in prison, and it's really hard to like explain at first to your friends and family like what you're going to do, but it was the best experience I have ever had at Ohio State.
Is that common? Are students sometimes a little nervous about what they've signed up for at first?
Everything Kaylee said is common. There's this hesitation, this fear. Sometimes parents are a bit unsure. Oh, I don't know if I want you going in a prison. And again, it's because of the image that we have in our carceral society. But students often leave the class feeling that it is the best class that they've ever took. I've had students before tell me they wish they had discovered OP before their senior year so they could have taken multiple classes, because it really does change people's perspective on not only incarcerated individuals, but really our criminal justice system as a whole. It opens their eyes to the problems that permeate our society and the way that we treat and criminalize and marginalize typically already marginalized populations.
What have some of the incarcerated students had to say about the program?
Very similar transformative experience. For many of them, it is the best experience they've had while they're incarcerated. Educational opportunities are very limited in prison settings, and to have access to quality higher education is really an exceptional and unique opportunity. And so in that space, when they're interacting with their professors and with campus students, it is one of the few spaces where they get to be normal, where people see beyond the labels that have been put on them, where people see beyond the uniform and the clothes that they're forced to wear, and really value them and see them as peers and intellectual scholars who are capable of, again, creating and producing knowledge.
You're working to expand the range of prison-based curriculum offerings, including getting degree programs into some of these facilities. Can you tell us about that effort? I think it's with the Women's Correctional Facility.
Yes, we actually launched our bachelor's program at the Ohio Reformatory for Women in Marysville this semester. So we have a cohort of 20 students who are working towards a degree in women's gender and sexuality studies. So they are taking two classes this semester, with campus students who are also coming to the prison. And so to our knowledge, this is the first women's studies degree program in a prison in the United States.
That's so exciting.
It is very exciting.
And so they're kind of college freshmen.
They are. Essentially, yes, they are college freshmen.
They must be so excited. Is it going to take, do you think it'll take 4 years, or how long do you think the degree program will take for these women?
They're going part-time this year, so, and they'll start full-time in autumn 25, so it'll take about 5 years for them to finish. But for many of them, it is a dream because everybody's a Buckeye, right? And to have this opportunity to enroll and to be a student at Ohio State is really a dream come true for many of them.
Where does the funding for this come from?
Well, we have several sources of funding. OPEEP's overall budget, our foundational budget, came from the Office of the Provost. We also received...
Nice to have that kind of support.
Absolutely. The degree program was an institution-wide effort. It involved financial aid. It involved advising. It involved so many entities and offices on campus. But we also received money from the Mellon Foundation. And the Mellon Foundation actually provided some kind of seed money for us to get this program up and running. It also has sponsored a learning community that we have at the women's prison, Liberation at the Margins Collective. In that space, we've been meeting over a year with women in LAM Collective every other week, engaging in reading and studying about Black feminist principles and pedagogies. And that really serves as the intellectual foundation for the work that we do at ORW. And about half of the participants in LAM Collective are actually now enrolled in the degree program.
I mean, when you think of, you know, somebody who's going to spend a decade in prison, getting an Ohio State degree isn't the first thing that comes to mind. It's got to be so transformative for these women.
It is. And it's also unique because, as I said earlier, educational opportunities are limited, and they're typically limited to people who have 5 years to the gate.
I didn't know that.
So people with 10-year sentences, life sentences, oftentimes don't have the opportunity to access higher education. And one of the things that Jennifer Sanders, who is the superintendent of the school system for ODRC, she wanted us to make sure that we included folks with a life sentence. And so all of the women who are involved in our program actually have 11 years or more. So they are long-term individuals at ORW who, for many of them, this is going to be their first time accessing these opportunities at the facility.
That's such a different way of thinking about it, because you think of a life sentence and you think, I guess instinctually, and it's probably incorrect and speaks to my own bias, you think, well, why would they need this? But, like, why wouldn't they need it?
Exactly. And that also speaks to the utility of a liberal arts program, because the curriculum, the humanities liberal arts curriculum in general, is about getting knowledge of the self, knowledge of humanity, and very specifically why we want it to be at ORW and why we want it to have a degree in women's studies is because these women have experienced cis-heteropatriarchy. They have been subjected to sexism and misogyny. A lot of the reasons that they are incarcerated have to do with gendered oppression in our society. So this helps them better understand their positionality. It helps them better understand the systems of oppression that have historically and continue to confine their lives.
Yeah, one of the things I've learned in covering issues like this over the years is that a lot of women in prison have had sexual trauma in their past. A lot of times it's as children. They've had very tumultuous childhoods.
Exactly.
And it's unfortunate that that set them on a course that landed them where they were.
Mm-hmm. And we oftentimes don't have the support systems to give them what they need to get out of that situation or to prevent them from ending up in a prison facility.
You know, you have a video on the program's website of this student who says that the program changed the course of her collegiate journey and altered her career path. I mean, that's huge to say they took this class and it forever changed how they wanted to conceive of their life.
Yes, we've had students change their major. We have had students decide not to go into corrections and to go to law school instead.
Huh.
So it has that significant of an impact.
What's next for you guys? I mean, you're starting this degree program, huge undertaking. Do you want to see that in more prisons across Ohio?
We would love to see it in more prisons. We currently teach in 5 prisons, so we teach in 4 men's facilities as well. Southeastern Correctional Institution, London Correctional Institution, Allen Oakwood, and Richland Correctional Institutions. So in the next few years, we would actually like to have a degree program at one of the men's facilities in African American and African Studies.
Oh, that would be great. I wonder, are other states ever reaching out to you? Or are they like, hey, what are you up to over there?
We actually participate in a consortium with other Big Ten schools that have higher education in prison projects.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so there are several universities across the country that are doing similar work.
Why do you think that's taken off in recent years? It feels like we hear a lot about criminal justice reform at the State House, and it's gotten a lot of bipartisan support in recent years. I feel like there's been this, I don't know, we've hit a tipping point in the way we think about corrections.
Mm-hmm. I think many people are beginning to realize that we incarcerate more individuals as a nation than any other industrialized nation, and that incarceration really is not a deterrent to crime. And really what we need to be focusing on is eliminating the oppressions in our society and not criminalizing behavior that people actually need support for, right? So not criminalizing addiction, not criminalizing poverty, not criminalizing gender and sexuality, right? And other marginalized identities in this country. And the way that we handle quote unquote criminal behavior is not effective. It is not productive for our society. And we're doing much more harm and creating much more harm when we incarcerate people.
Yeah, one of the things that came up earlier is more than 90% of people who enter prison will leave prison.
Right.
And one of this is really thinking about, well, what kind of person comes out the other end of this?
Right. And then who is on the outside to receive them? So part of our work on campus is really about shifting consciousness at OSU and making sure that we are an institution that is welcoming, that is providing support for justice-impacted individuals when they come back into our community.
It kind of gets at both ends, though, right? Like, it gets at the people, the judges, the lawyers, the correctional officers who will one day interact with them, and then themselves in terms of the education that they have, the opportunities that they have when they leave. You're kind of coming at it from both ends.
Absolutely. And so it is also about, yes, providing them that education so they can be the engaged and active students that we want OSU students to be.
You wrote a book in 2015, Woman Power Unlimited and the Black Freedom Struggle in Mississippi. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that and how it fits into this conversation that we're having, because it seems like I have not read the book, but it seems really interesting. I have to add it to my TBR.
Please do. It is a book about a Black women civil rights organization that was based in Mississippi. And it really looks at the ways that Black women contributed to the movement in Mississippi, but the civil rights movement on a national level, and the ways that Black women have engaged in activism historically is really to just do the work, to not be concerned about ego, to not be concerned about recognition and acknowledgement, but just to make sure that what needed to be done was done. And so even though they didn't necessarily consider themselves to be feminists, that is kind of the heart of Black feminist ideology and activism. And that is also the foundation of the Ohio Prison Education Exchange Project. Our project is really grounded in Black feminist principles and pedagogy. So focusing on social justice and transformative justice, focusing on community building and humanity and liberation.
It reminded me a bit. We did a show a couple weeks ago, a couple months ago. It's all blurring together with the election, but about the Lincoln School marchers and how it was one of the longest sustained civil rights marches. And I just never, ever heard of it until I came across it.
And that's part of why I wrote the book, to really shine a light on those everyday local people who are doing the work that we typically aren't aware of, because we generally have this top-down perspective of, and a very male-centered perspective of, the movement and of activism. So to really show what folks on the ground were doing and valuing the lived experiences of, again, people who tend to be marginalized.
Do you teach any of the classes inside these facilities, or are you just more of a faculty advisor role? How does that work?
Well, so I and Dr. Thomas co-direct the program, but we also teach classes. So I previously taught at Franklin Medical Center. This past spring, I taught at Southeastern Correctional Institution. I taught the Civil Rights and Black Power Movement. And then, next academic year, I'll be teaching again at the Ohio Reformatory for Women in the degree program.
What's that been like for you personally?
They have been some of the best students that I've taught, because they come to the classroom ready to learn. They are eager. I can always count on them to have read the material.
They do their homework.
They do their homework. And they also actually raise the bar for the campus students. Not that the campus students are poor students by any means, but they definitely elevate the intellectual discussion in the space.
College life has more distractions.
Right.
Oh, that's true. I wouldn't have thought about that. If there was like a really great, like if the Buckeyes beat Michigan and everybody's out celebrating, the folks at the correctional facility are still doing their homework.
Right. No, they do. They do have full lives as well. That's one of the stereotypes. We often think that they are just sitting in their cell, 23 hours out of the day, but they have a great deal of programming. They have other activities. They have jobs that they do as well. So they do, too, have challenges with finding quiet spaces and quiet time to study. Mm. So in addition to our classes for the degree program, we do have study halls and office hours at the facility.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah.
My final question for you is, we are based here at Ohio State University's main campus. If there are students or parents of students listening and thinking, my kid would probably be really interested in this, how do they go about finding the program, getting involved?
You can find information on our website, opeep.osu.edu, or you can follow us on Instagram at opeep_OSU. And we have just opened up registration for spring classes. We'll be having two classes at the Ohio Reformatory for Women, three classes at London Correctional Institution, and two classes at Southeastern Correctional Institution. So please go to our website, apply, and tell all your friends.
And OPEEP is OPEEP.
Yes.
Just like it sounds. That was T. Morris, the director of the Ohio Prison Education Exchange Program, or OPEEP. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, how incarcerated people and Ohio State students formed a book club. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Saver. We're talking about programs that bring people into prisons this hour. And almost always, they turn out to be two-way learning sessions. Beginning in October, there is a program that pairs Ohio State medical students with women at the Ohio Reformatory for Women. And it starts again, I should say. It's been ongoing, but it starts back up. Nicolette Lay is a second-year medical student at Ohio State, and she's the project leader of this program called House Call. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit about House Call. What is the program?
Right. So House Call actually started in 2020 as a book club. And it was also a space for these women at the Ohio Reformatory for Women to share about their healthcare experiences. And then over the years, it kind of evolved into more of a health discussion space and kind of a community building space, and really a space where women could like find ways to take control of their health. We can discuss and kind of build connections between both the med students and the women at ORW.
So it started on Zoom, obviously, because it started during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Do you guys do mostly Zoom, or has it moved more in person?
So we actually host hybrid sessions. A lot of the students want to go in person because it's easier to make connections in person. But then we always have a student stay behind, or at least one student stay behind, to kind of man the Zoom. And in that way, we're able to project slides and any like additional like visuals that we want to show.
So you were part of the program last year. I have to ask, what initially made you want to get involved?
So I've been kind of working towards kind of unpacking incarceration in my own personal life, having grown up in communities, neighborhoods, and really a family that was affected by incarceration. And then last fall, I just suddenly had an email from House Call, and it was just kind of a fortunate timing, and things just worked out like that.
Are you guys still doing the book club at all, or is it just moved to more of like a healthcare conversation?
So we're no longer doing the book club, but I can't really say that we're only doing healthcare conversations, because our sessions also include kind of an element of humanism. We try to incorporate poetry into every session, and then each session we also incorporate a couple of reflection questions at the end for both the med students and the ORW women to answer and share.
You also talk about nutrition. You talk about reproductive health. One of the things I found fascinating in some of the other articles and interviews about House Call is that there'll be women in the facility who's like, I've had PCOS my whole life, and I didn't understand what that meant until we had a presentation on it.
Yeah. So we talk about a lot of different issues, and a lot of times the women are very engaging and they ask questions about their own personal health. A lot of questions such as, I wake up like this in the morning. I'm not sure I understand this. Can you help me like understand this? Can you explain this in a different way? And the med students are always there to explain and kind of work through different explanations for those questions. In one session, we did MSK, musculoskeletal health and bone health, and we paired that with kind of movements and exercises to stay active. And some of the women asked about, oh, I have this mobility limitation. How can I adapt it to continue to stay active in any way that I can? And so that was an interesting experience as well.
That's got to be so interesting as a medical student to have these kinds of questions, because they are essentially questions you may get in the real world.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, they're absolutely questions you have in the real world. And it's an interesting experience, especially because we don't really get a lot of experience speaking to people who have been incarcerated, really in medical school, outside of medical school. So it's an interesting experience to be able to have this conversation, but also at the same time, learn from people who are in the situation.
Yeah, there aren't medical exams in this, but it's more of a sharing of medical knowledge.
Mm-hmm. It's a sharing of medical knowledge. It's a community building space. It's a space to share experiences and kind of reflect on journeys and growth.
It also sounds like you're giving them the tools to have conversations with their providers in the prison, like giving them the words and the vocabulary to talk about what they may be experiencing.
Yeah, we definitely do try to do that. And towards the later sessions, we actually have a type of role play that we do. And we provide scripts, and we ask for two participants to volunteer, and they read out a script. And we'll have a scenario where the interaction is less of a good exchange, less of a shared decision-making exchange. And then another scenario where things go a little better. And we kind of try to talk through those scenarios to see if we can in any way improve these women's and their ability to advocate for themselves as patients within the system.
Oh, I think that's so important. It's so easy not to speak up. I don't know, in my own experience, it's taken like time and age to get confident and be like, no, actually, that's not what I'm experiencing. This is what's going on.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely difficult. And I think it's a lot more difficult considering the situation that these women are in. And especially for certain health issues, like we do 2 sessions of women's health, and that's always accompanied by a disclaimer that, yes, these topics are awkward, these topics can be uncomfortable, but we want to create a safe space and an open space for conversation to share your experiences and like any concerns that you may have with your own health.
On one visit last year, you asked everyone to write a poem, both the women and the students. What was that like?
It was a very popular session, actually. And that was the first session that we began kind of using poetry towards the end of our sessions. And it was so popular that since that session, we started incorporating a poem at the end of each session to like read out. And then we'd have a moment of like collective breath to like finish off the session.
Did you think that when you started at the College of Medicine that you'd be incorporating poetry into your education?
I didn't. I didn't at all, actually. But it's been a very interesting experience. It's been very rewarding to have something additionally, like besides just straight biomedicine in my education. And especially through House Call, you learn so much from people in person. And you also get to learn from fellow students who you might not even see that often when you're in class.
Yeah, they might be in different disciplines, different years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think it's changed the kind of doctor you're going to become? Or maybe it's too soon to ask that question.
I'll say, I always get the question of like, what doctor do you want to be? What specialty do you want to go into? And I can never answer that question because I don't know. But I'll say that House Call has really made me focus in on the communities that I want to serve. I want to serve underserved communities, immigrant communities, and especially incarcerated communities. And that's something that I realized about myself and something that I'm looking to explore in the future.
What has been the reaction from the women that go through this program, the incarcerated women, I mean?
Yeah, they've really enjoyed it. And we actually asked for feedback towards the end of the sessions. And I can read a piece
for you
if you would like.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So we got this as a piece of feedback. We handed out note cards in the session and we were able to take home a couple of pieces. Being a participant has been very fulfilling. It has given me a sense of normalcy to hang out with a group of women, educate one another while being vulnerable and transparent with no judgment. I've gained so much knowledge, laughed, cried, and bonded with women from another world. But on Tuesday nights, we are one. Thank you all.
I love that. We are one.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's, yeah, it's very easy to other the people in prison.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially because, you know, we have all these conversations about health disparities and health equity, but really, we never see much about incarcerated populations. They're isolated from the conversation and they're isolated from physically from the general population. And so it's difficult. And especially for future physicians who may be interacting with these populations, it's important to have these experiences and to not other them, as you said.
You know, I asked the same question earlier that, you know, we are at Ohio State University. We're right across the street from campus. Mm-hmm. If there are people listening, medical students who want to get involved, how do they get involved?
So they can look up the Ohio State University Physicians for Human Rights Group. And that's the group, the student organization of which we are under. And they can reach out to them and we will be in contact.
Is it too late to get in for October?
Absolutely not. We welcome all med students and all students to join us. It's a very rewarding experience. It's definitely been the highlight of my med school years.
I understand that you have a phrase that you printed and taped to your wall. Can you tell us what it was and why that resonates with you?
Yeah, yeah. It was the phrase, on Tuesday nights, we were one. I actually printed out that index card onto my wall because I didn't keep the physical index card. And I had that on my wall and it was really a big part of getting myself through my first year of medical school. I think I had some issues transitioning and some issues kind of figuring out why it mattered that I was in med school. And really focusing on the work and the impact that I, a first-year med student, had at ORW was really impactful in getting me through that and getting me kind of focused on what I want to do in my future.
Yeah, I can't imagine med school is an easy program to get through.
It's interesting. It's interesting for sure.
Interesting is the word I use for gifts that I don't like.
Oh, that's
interesting. No, but you know, I think what I really like about this program is it's just, it feels very, I don't want to say casual, but like intimate, but casual, but relaxed. It doesn't sound like you guys are lecturing at them.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure. We're not getting to the ORW facility and standing in the front with slides. We do have slides. We do project slides. But really, we sit in a big circle and the students sit amongst the women. So we're able to have side conversations as like the material is being presented. And then a lot of the session is reflections. We get to share about our journeys, our problems, how we feel isolated in one way or another, and reflect on how we've grown and what we're taking away. So yeah, like you said, it's not, it's intimate, it's more casual, it's not a formal, oh, I'm sitting here and taking notes and there will be a test at the end of this.
So there are no tests.
No, there are no tests. But we do present certificates of completion at our final session.
Oh, that's nice, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. I understand that this is part of the Physicians for Human Rights program at Ohio State. How mm-hmm. does that fit in?
So the Physician for Human Rights organization at OSU does a lot of these types of projects. There are projects focused on immigrant health, on homelessness, on LGBTQ health. And so House Call fits into this in that the PHR group really wants to advocate for patients and wants to find different ways for medical students to interact with underserved populations and vulnerable populations and get this experience to, you know, to improve how they will see their career in the future. And so that's how House Call fits into this.
Do you participate in any of those or no, just House Call?
So I participate primarily in House Call, but I did participate last year a bit in PHR. There we had a winter coat drive
that was
really successful.
Oh, so it's not just like formal programming. It's actually just like, yeah, like on the ground.
It's on the ground stuff too. Yeah. So there's it's on the ground stuff.
That's really neat. I guess I hadn't considered all of the things that you, like, med school just feels like such an overwhelming task to take upon yourself to then go above and beyond and do all these extra programs.
Yeah, so I'd say that myself, my classmates, really everyone that I've met at med school has been very passionate about a variety of topics besides going to class, passing tests. Everyone's very passionate in becoming the best physician that they can be in the future, in serving communities, and in kind of learning more about ways that they can make an impact as med students and as future physicians.
One article said that you guys also share your own stresses, your own worries. You actually talk about the things that are maybe uncomfortable for you as well as the women.
Yeah, yeah, we absolutely do that. And like I said, we have reflection questions at the end of each session where we share, you know, what have I gone through this year? How can I be more kind to myself? What wins can I count to make myself get through things more? And it's really helpful because we can see the commonalities between what the women at ORW go through and what the med students go through. You know, we all feel at points in our lives isolated. We all feel that we're not doing enough, that we've messed up in one way or another. And it's really nice to be in a room with other people who agree and who can affirm what you're saying.
Yeah, that stress is stress no matter what the circumstances.
Yeah, yeah, really that.
I assume you also talk about stress management techniques.
We do. We talk a lot about stress management and how to let go of things, how to find ways to channel your stress. We also talk a bit about sleep hygiene and how that's important in managing stress and mental health.
Yeah, that's a good one. I wonder, what have the women taught you maybe about resilience or about life? Like, what is your takeaway from participating in the program?
I would say that my takeaway from these women is that life changes in so many different ways. There are so many things that can happen, but you still have to move on. You still have to adapt. You have to overcome things. And sometimes that comes with a little improvisation because you don't really know what's going on. But at the end of the day, you're here. You're thankful to be here in one way or another. And life continues.
That was Nicolette Lay, a second-year medical student at Ohio State and the project leader of House Call. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
And I want to say thank you to all of our staff here who makes All Sides possible. Producers Marcus Charleston and Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz. Intern producers Kira Kattar, Chris Corcoran, and David Stein. And thank you so much to our wonderful board operator this morning, Chris Johnston. And last but certainly not least, thank you all for listening to All Sides right here on 89.7 NPR News.